Session number 8735.
Dr. Saxton, tape 6.
Julian Bell then was injured by a portion of a bomb which came horizontally underneath the ambulance under which he was sheltering, having jumped out and got underneath while he was on the way to the front to pick up some wounded. He was brought into us in very poor shape. I've already recounted this. He had half his wallet blown into his side of his chest, and he was transfused and taken up to the surgeon, Mr. Brogy, Catalan, who survived the war, I may say, and was rehabilitated ultimately after a long time. Became a wealthy man, but always a friend of ours, and subsequently became the president of the Catalan Medical, I forget what kind of organization, Academy, Catalan Academy of Medicine. Julian Bell was on the operating table and had his wound cleaned up as far as was reasonably possible, and simply patched over. It was impossible to clean the wound properly. It was a lack of facilities doing lung surgery. He died within 12 hours or so. There was really nothing more we could do for him. Some of the remains of his property, in fact, I brought home with me, so that's an indication of when I went on leave, and gave to his relatives.
So that would imply your leave came after his death, is that right?
I think
yes.
Right, so that operation of that... is it Fuencarril, isn't it? The famous centre where this monastery was. No, it wasn't. No. I've got the wrong name again, but I'll find it later. That was the name where the cemetery was, where so many international brigaders were buried. Fuencarril, I think. The battle there wasn't very satisfactory, and it drew to an inconclusive end.
Were the casualties quite large?
Yes, there were very heavy casualties. Mm. Our forces were considerably outnumbered and outgunned. Not that that always is decisive. For instance, in Jarama, it wasn't decisive. I think the determination of the forces is sometimes more decisive than the weaponry. Nevertheless, we were defeated, and the process of a gradual retreat and setting up hospitals in all sorts of small places here and there and everywhere, in little schools in some places and in tents in others, and any building we could find, any kind of shelter, proceeded for some time. And I can't recall another major engagement in which we were concerned, although I'm sure there were several engagements of intermediate size, you might say, until Teruel.
Yes, before I go on to that, could I ask you a little more about the sort of shifts you were doing at this stage in Brunete? Yes. Were you working, very hard, the teams of doctors and nurses?
Yes. There were really no shifts. You just worked as long as you could, and according to the numbers of patients coming in and who was there to deal with them. And you might take off an hour or two to get a little sleep or food, but you might equally well be called out when you were sleeping and tell there was more to be done, so that no reasonable form of shift system.
Were you exhausted at the end of this? Did you find that you could stand up to such demands, or did you get very exhausted?
Fairly well. Of course, there were times when it was idle, you see, for a day or two. and there wasn't much to do, and then we could rest and get a little fresh air and go for a stroll and even go into the local museum and see all where all the kings were buried in this icy cold day. So it was terribly hot outside, and I was just wandering around in a pair of shorts, otherwise nothing, practically speaking, and then to go into this icy cold mausoleum, or whatever you would call it, down the basement of this building. It was an extraordinary contrast.
Was there any bombing of that area?
I can't recollect bombing anywhere near where we were, because it was desired not to damage this thing with such strong royal connections. I can't recollect any bombing there. But, of course, bombing further afield, where, in fact, Julian Bell received his mortal wound.
Mm. Yes. How about the blood supply? How were you coping at this time with your supply of blood? Because I understand at one time you did try to get it from the dead bodies.
Oh,
what would it have been around this time?
I think that was rather later. In one of the smaller engagements, where we were working in some little school somewhere in the middle of nowhere, you might say. No, at the particular time we have been talking about, I had some stored blood from Madrid still, but I was also using the donors recruited mainly from the staff. We managed to get more careful tests done at this stage, and not only grouping, which is straightforward business, but tests for diseases which the patients might suffer from. It was a rather unhappy event when one of our donors, who was a French doctor who was working with us, was found to be suffering from quite a severe disease as a result of checking him as a blood donor. And this really meant we had to lose this, because we had to go almost immediately back to Paris, and we lost the use of a valuable doctor that way. So the checking as a wasn't so useful to us as a unit, although of course he had to go because he needed urgent treatment. And I can well remember him the day when I told him that. And he was wandering around saying, zut alors, all the time. And he said, no, can't be true. So I had to send in another specimen under a false name so that he could be convinced. And it came out just the same, and he was sent home. Odd enough, our medical chief at that time for this group, I think it was over Dr. Cram, who was our divisional medical man. Well, he became divisional medical man after this, but yes, that's right. This was before Belchite, and we had a Dr. Dumont, who was worked in Paris, who was a high-class pathologist, who came to Spain out of protest, mainly, at the lack of response, because the communist parties throughout Europe were calling for volunteers to go, and it was then hoped that I don't know what percentage, but of every branch of the communist party would produce, say, 50% or some quite high percentage of their members as volunteers to go to Spain. It wasn't that figure, I don't know what the figure was, but a percentage. And in his particular branch of the party, there are so few volunteers. Although he had this very important position, which would had carried political weight too in France, he said, well, if none of you fellows are going, I'm going. And so he came, and he was very quickly in a leading position. Now, Dr. Dumont died in Belchite. Well, see, he was in the forward lines with the fighting at that moment, when the fighting was one of the moments when the fighting was highest. Belchite was completely destroyed in the fighting, but he was there doing some I don't know why he was so far forward, but most organisers stayed back, but he was far forward. And at that moment, in the height of the fighting, you're never quite sure when a person is going to be a prisoner or still has some fight in him. And many people who were prepared to surrender or to give up, or even had given up in the height of the ferocity of the fighting, they still get killed. You can imagine the sort of situation of people house-to-house fighting, going round buildings with guns and so on. At any rate, it so happened that Dr. Dumont, who was close to the front, was observing some of this hand-to-hand fighting, and he saw a person who was obviously surrendering, about to be killed by one of our people. You can imagine the fury and the hatred and the fear and the tense situation. And he stopped this soldier from killing the man who was prepared to surrender. But then he himself exposed himself to being shot and was killed. And that was the end of Dumont. That's when Dr. Crome took over the leadership of the medical department of the 35th Division. And so I've got a little bit off the track.
No, this is all very interesting. I was wondering also how you were coping for supplies of things like, you know, anaesthetic and drugs. Yeah.
Well,
medicines.
We got quite a lot, as I said, from Great Britain. But there were official supplies by the government, and we could send in requisitions for certain things, and indeed we could get them. I can remember at a certain stage I was very much concerned with surgical shock, which fitted in well with transfusion, even better than I realised at the time, because surgical shock is in fact mainly due to loss of fluid, loss of blood. Almost 100% of primary surgical shock at the beginning, within the first 24 hours of a wound, for instance, is almost entirely due to loss of blood. Transfusion was more important than we realized, although we realized it was important, but not that important. We thought there were many other factors concerned, as well as the actual loss of blood, as indeed there are much later on, the following week maybe, the following few days after the bleeding. And I was reading about this to a certain extent. I saw some medical journals now and then. And I was wondering whether we could replace the fluid. We couldn't get enough blood with salines. And there was a suggestion that this could be, it could help the patient by giving them glucose with insulin. Insulin helps the body to use glucose, right, as you know, but diabetics more. And I wanted to put in glucose salines with an appropriate amount of insulin to make that available rapidly for a patient in shock. And so I, with Dr. Crome's signature and so on, I went to Valencia with this document requisite or requisition a request for a supply of insulin and glucose, and I got it from medical government stores of these materials. So there were official sources of supply. Instruments were more difficult to get, but then we had a lot of those coming from England. But ordinary medicaments within reason were available on the medical requisitions.
Did you get anything from the Soviet Union in the way of medical supplies or instruments?
I don't recall medical supplies. We certainly got foodstuffs. I can well remember some most tasty tinned meat we had, flavoured with onion and all sorts of things, which really is a nice change after all that dried codfish that we lived on. Yes, we did get supplies of surgery, and of course the fighting forces got Russian weapons. How they arrived? Well, by devious methods. See, it was difficult to get in, to bring stuff in by sea, though it did come in by sea. There was the well-known ship that was carrying mainly food, the Komsomol, that was sunk somewhere. I forget which port it was going for, but various boats were sunk and attacked off Barcelona and other ports, mainly by the German Navy. Many of the weapons, I believe, were imported via Mexico. Seems an awful long way around, I suppose, because apparently if they came from some other country than the Soviet Union, there was less likelihood of them being interfered with. But we got Russian weapons did come in, tanks, machine guns, planes. At one stage, for a short time, the Republican Air Force, supplied with Russian planes, was able to dominate the air of Madrid for a short time. Didn't last for long.
How important to you was Madrid in the Spanish Civil War?
It was the nerve centre and administrative centre, government centre, because it was a centralised government. Admittedly, there was and still are these separatist tendencies, especially more than any, I would say, well, the Basque country, of course, but I was thinking more of Catalonia. And there was a nationalist tendency and tendency to break away from the centre in Catalonia all the time. But during the war, they held together pretty well.
It's because this offensive itself was connected with Madrid, wasn't it, Brunetti?
To relieve the pressure, I think, on Madrid, as far as I recollect. I must say I'm very ignorant about the sort of detailed matters of the military situation.
Yes, well, your attention was focused elsewhere, of course, rather. Wasn't it?
I would have been interested, and I was interested, and yet I never seemed to have time to think hard about it. I had other things pressing on my mind, yes. So, say the next. Oh yes, you were asking about this cadaver blood. Well, I had read of some work done on cadaver blood transfusion. Now, I think the original work was actually done in the Soviet Union. I'm not sure where it was done. I think it was in the Soviet Union. At any rate, I thought, well, from time to time, there are a lot of dead people around who have no further use for their blood. It might be as well, if it were feasible and safe and all the rest of it, to make use of some of that, because we are desperately short. We are bleeding our staff such a lot and all the rest of it, and you can't always get the stored blood. As you saw, one of those, as I showed you in a picture, one of those little hospitals and places I was at, I was screaming down a field telephone, which you could hardly hear what you were, hear anything. And they were trying to get stored blood from Barcelona at that stage. I was prepared, if opportunity offered, to investigate and see to what extent it was seemed safe to use cadaver blood, or indeed to collect it. And in a particular small hospital, we were at one of these fleeting hospitals where we sort of set up for a week and then moved quickly to some other place as the military situation changed. There was a temporary air raid shelter in which three soldiers, I suppose they were buried alive and suffocated. And I took blood from one of these men simply to observe it, really, to see what possibilities there were. And I observed what had been reported in the literature I read about it, that after it had clotted, the clot cleared ultimately and left Not a clear fluid, but a fluid that flowed quite normally without any solid, macroscopically solid objects. And this seemed to me a useful point. Why it did it, I wasn't sure. And that was really as far as I got to observe that it appeared to be a feasible thing. But really, with the facilities I had, it was difficult to take the blood, to take it safely. And if a patient had been actually severely wounded, as opposed to these people who had been suffocated, then the blood in circulation would probably be contaminated. So it's a rather limited type of donor you could get that was reasonably safe. And then, of course, it would be difficult to carry out any, well, elaborate examination of the blood in field conditions. Well, you could group it, that was easy enough, but as for testing it for other disease processes, this would be rather difficult in field conditions. Not impossible. But still, the possibility of getting suitable donors, suitable dead donors, was not very great. And I dropped the idea.
Was it continued in any other theatre?
No.
That process? Or, you know, in later years?
No, I don't think it was ever seriously taken up. Of course, you see, in civilian conditions, there would be tremendous opposition on whatever grounds you like, but emotional grounds you like, or various other grounds. People wouldn't like the idea, and you can understand it wouldn't be done in ordinary civilian conditions because of the feelings it would arouse. But of course, in war conditions, it would not be. So,
yes, there are sort of overtones of Dracula, aren't there, with this, I suppose, in normal conditions.
Oh, yes.
But it was never, so far as you know, continued in war conditions.
No, I don't think it ever came to any practical result anywhere. It was a sort of tentative idea, and I could see the great advantage of it. Here you've got a donor who's no further use for his blood. You can take the last, every last drop that's worth having. You know, I mean, you might get, but you wouldn't get a gallon of blood instead of a pint, you know. Anyway, right, half a gallon without too much trouble if it was if the person was whole still.
What happened to the dead? You know, because there must have been vast numbers at times from what you have described.
Just buried under the ground, or if you were retreating, you had to leave them overground.
Did that often happen?
Well, in rapid retreats, it certainly happened, because some of our dead people, because it was daylight, it was impossible to go and pick them up for fear of being shot yourself. So you had to wait for cover of darkness to collect them. And then if you suddenly had to retreat before the darkness arrived, they had to be left. And this happened to many of our fighters.
Did you have many rapid retreats yourself? You know, were there occasions when you had to vacate a hospital pretty quickly?
I don't think there were any sort of occasions when there was no notice at all. You just had to drop everything and run for it. I don't think that ever happened.
You were always able to evacuate your patients, were you?
Yes. It's funny how one suddenly thinks of a particular patient. Well, where was this case? I can't remember. I remember a very young, rather frail, but not unhealthily frail, a small. He wasn't a fully grown boy, I think he was 17 perhaps, you know. Adolescent, almost grown up young fellow, so pathetic. And yet, obviously, a nice boy, you know, but of the enemy. well, probably recruited, enrolled, on, you know, without knowing why or having any option. And I remember him coming to us, and this battle. I think it was the Ebro. We had to leave that hospital in a bit of a hurry. So we had to evacuate this fellow, and he was so frightened of what might happen to him, because he was held by the enemy, but he had a broken leg, he was in plaster, and it was all sort of hanging up on some kind of Balkan beam, as you used to call them, and he was quite helpless, supposed to. And trying to sort of ingratiate himself with us to, in some way, and so... And I wasn't all that aware of the history of Spain. I had a few ideas of Federation past, and it dawned on one of what he was saying in the end, because he said, Viva el 14 de abril. I hope I've got the date right. Long live the 14th of April, which is the day when the Republic was established. It's a sort of special holiday day, you know, a special celebrated day. He had all the best treatment we could give, and he was evacuated with the rest of the patients in a perfectly orderly sort of way.